Hello. I hope you enjoyed the craft of Stan Rogers, who had perfected his ability to tell a story by the age of 33 when a careless, well, criminal smoking accident aboard an airplane cost him his life. I think we are ready, after due consideration of the world of the sea, to reflect a bit upon the nature of the world of the law with respect to the Mignonette's dinghy and the lives of Tom Dudley and Edwin Stevens and Nettie Brooks and Richard Parker. The pivot of the reality of the shipwreck and its aftermath is the difference between the opinions of the public, at least that portion of the public which lived in close economic and social relation to the sea, on the one hand, and that portion of the public largely entrusted with government, which brought to the question what Edward Cook calls the artificial reason of the law. It is possible to disentangle two strands of the maritime community's belief concerning the nature of the experience through which four men went and three survived. The world of the sea believes two things. First, that there are times in which people must be sacrificed to save others under conditions of immediate survival stress. And second, that when such a killing must occur, there should be a drawing of lots, apparently a symbol of the equality of everybody's chances, though we should dig a little deeper into that in a moment. On the lawyer's side, there is a similar set of disentangling to undertake, but it reflects itself in the ordinary processes, or at least something simulating the ordinary processes of adversary criminal justice. That is, there are those who believe that it is important to establish in a formal way, a formal common law way, by a leading case, by a strong judicial articulation, that there is no such thing as a defense of necessity in homicide. And those who believe that the matter is not capable of a clear and certain legal judgment, and who believe that some form of common law decision-making is required, but in the nature of case-by-case adjudication, slowly raising the possibility of inferring a rule rather than stating it and then deductively sentencing to death men like Tom Dudley. The disposition within the leadership of the law is perhaps less evident than appears on the face of the story. While all the lawyers in power, from Harcourt at the Home Office, to Baron Huddleston, to Dankwerts, the Treasury solicitor, while all the parties judicially and administratively in control of the legal system seem to hew pretty closely to the first opinion, that is, that what is necessary is a leading case affirmatively disavowing the possibility of necessity defense in homicide, parties of distinction, whether they are James Fitz James Stevens on the one hand or Arthur Collins on the other, are at least doubtful about the possibility of such a bright line rule. And as you see, subsequent commissions engaged in law reform dealing with the substantive criminal law in England, the equivalent, if you like, of the mummery and charade carried on in the United States by the American Law Institute. The great and the good in their chewing over of the matter in the second half of the 19th century repeatedly found themselves unwilling to declare one way or the other. It's a jurisprudential problem for them, as it was in the 20th century for Lon Fuller with his famous science fiction example of the spelunkers trapped underground. Everybody understands that there is philosophic points of departure from which one can reach either a principle born of utilitarianism, at least for a 19th century Englishman, born of utilitarianism, in which necessity is a defense in homicide under circumstances that clearly indicate whether one is pursuing these science fiction examples, Derek Parfit's trolley problem, or the self-driving car equivalents of the trolley problem that were referred to in our last office hours discussion. Or some form of relatively simple moral judgment, some deontological conviction that thou shalt not kill, or that killing is wrong, or whatever. It's important, of course, to grasp that the law treats this problem as a problem of homicide, not a problem of cannibalism. There may be criminal sanctions for behaving inappropriately with dead bodies. I violated in March of 2001 the criminal law of the state of California when I disposed of my father's ashes in the Pacific Ocean. Scattering my father's ashes at Greyhound Rock violated a California administrative provision requiring a license for the disposal of human ashes, whether at sea or otherwise. And that administrative provision certainly contains the possibility of fine for its violation. Similarly, one can say that there are administrative regulations connected with how one ought to treat the dead bodies of human beings, which don't include eating them. But it isn't cannibalism which is the felony. It isn't cannibalism which is the subject of the question of defense of necessity. It's homicide. And so while our attention is inevitably concentrated on the question of the eating, both because of cultural taboos involved and because it is the cannibalism which is both the motive of the killing and the indication of the extremis that would justify or might justify the killing. It is the killing itself which is the subject of the legal conversation and which represents the jeopardy to Dudley and Stevens. It isn't that they are going to be fined either for violation of the rules of maritime administration or for inappropriately dealing with the body of Richard Parker. In the end, the only way that they can deal with the body of Richard Parker is to bury it at sea, which is what is done. The question is whether eating any of it first increases the administrative doubt about the appropriateness of the treatment, but of course none of this is relevant at all. Richard Parker's tombstone, with the references both to Job and to the Acts, the latter being the quotation put there by his brother, lay not this to their charge, The tombstone of Richard Parker is eloquent and important, even though there is no particular body part of Richard Parker below it. Indeed, well, you know, I mean, it's a family plot, after all. But death at sea and burial at sea is as ancient as going down to the sea in ships, and it isn't their treatment of Parker's body in that sense which raises any legal question at all. Given their good faith belief that Richard Parker was dying anyway and that his death was only hours away, to what extent would we say in any other than the most technical legal sense that this is homicide? I know, having been involved in shortening my own father's life under conditions of his inevitable death from brain cancer mere days or weeks after the moment when he chose to die, that this question, hastening a death to avoid suffering, while the law may treat it as homicide under certain circumstances harshly, will always be seen by those who have experienced the suffering of the dying with a good deal of ambivalence, an ambivalence of a human character of which the law may be, shall we say, deliberately insensitive. The question then about what happened in the boat is not unfairly covered by one of the statements, in fact, two or three of the statements which either Dudley made himself or which Philippa later published from her conversations with him, namely that they hastened the boy's death to shorten his suffering and to enable their own survival. But this, the homicide, the shortening of Parker's life under what the people in the boat had every reason to believe, given their state of factual knowledge, was the inherent inevitability of his death in a short time. This is the subject, the substrate upon which the law wishes to work its magic. And without regard to the custom of the sea, or rather with regard to the custom of the sea in the sense of with the goal of overriding the custom of the sea in the most solemn, full-bottomed, wigged manner, amounting, after all, as it turns out, not merely to a pretend execution of Dudley and Stevens, but to their actually serving a term of criminal imprisonment in return for pardon, this is what, from the point of view of the law, the subject is. As those of you who read the whole book, in addition to the parts I assigned, can see, from the point of view of the officials of the law, the Treasury Solicitor, the Minister of the Home Office, and the trial judge, Baron Huddleston, this is an effort to close a gap, not in the life of the law, but in the literature of the law. There is no opinion, no leading case stating something which it has been their policy goal, that is, the managers of the legal system's policy goal, to fill for some time. If the Euxine prosecution had been possible, if everything had technically worked out, then there would have been at least, in the case reports, something appropriately like U.S. against Holmes, that is to say, the prosecution in 1849 for the throwing people from an overcrowded lifeboat that arose from the disaster of William Brown. For the lawyers then, particularly the lawyers in charge, not merely the man with the prosecution brief, is Arthur Charles, not merely the devious Baron Huddleston, more importantly the political authorities governing the law, making the prosecutorial decision, as some of you noted in the last conversation, doing so not with a sort of whole of government approach, as the current cliche is, but rather operating to the discomfort of the Board of Trade and other officials whose job it is to govern the maritime world, and for whom the prosecution is, as it is to Parker's family in Itchen Ferry, or to Philippa's relatives in the West Country, or to those who grew up on the water in the Clyde around Glasgow, or in Essex where Dudley himself was brought up. For all of these people, the formal prosecution of Dudley and Stevens for murder represents a kind of a complete misunderstanding and a failure to deal with the reality of what it is to be working men on the sea. Which isn't to say that there isn't something to agitate in that world. It's the matter of whether there were lots. And we need to come back to that subject in order to think more fully about the nature of the world in which the maritime community lives and what its mythologies, legends, folklore are. But for the folklore of the law, which is, as Thurman Arnold would say, the law and economics of whether you should be prepared to die of thirst and starvation sooner than to tinker with the life of another, or the body, the cadaver of another. For the folklore of the law, the subject isn't the lots. That's an irrelevancy to the purity of it all. Whether there is a defense of necessity in homicide after casting of lots is not a different question from whether there is a defense of necessity in homicide without the casting of lots. But the language of the law will, to some extent, accommodate what is, after all, not its prejudices, but the prejudices of those who disapprove of its invocation. Lots become a part of the peripheral part of the legal conversation because they are a not peripheral part of the vernacular conversation. With respect to its own processes, it is clear the system of law surrounding Dudley and Stevens is ruthlessly dishonest. The ruthless dishonesty of the legal system is the consequence of its effort to avoid losing the opportunity of a leading case. The Treasury solicitor and the Home Ministry and the devious Baron Huddleston himself are primarily concerned not to allow the facts of this hypothetical made real to be lost. It's a crisis too good to waste. If there is any technical problem that might cause them once again to let slip their opportunity to declare their unrealistic view of the situation in the boat, then they will flatten that technicality. They will remove that inconvenient fact. They will forge the necessary documents in order to make sure that the decision they envision may still be somehow preserved. Now, we can analyze the particulars of this with respect to Dudley and Stevens, but we ought not to be for an instant fooled into the belief that this is a unique circumstance, or even, for that matter, a particularly unusual circumstance. Huddleston is engaged in a work of forgery when he revises, after the jury last touched it, the special verdict he twisted their arm into rendering. Why was it so important to have a special verdict? Because otherwise, a jury in the Cornwall Assizes would almost surely have returned, as it has, as jurors have returned for hundreds of years, a verdict short of murder in order, well, to avoid what from their point of view is the manifest injustice of hanging Dudley and Stevens. Hence the careful effort to avoid a general verdict, which might be returned not guilty as to murder or guilty as to manslaughter. Hence the effort to avoid any possibility that the jury will be led to acquit, notwithstanding all of the effort at a special verdict, by this remarkable effort of accepting a recommendation for mercy when there hasn't been any conviction. All of this maneuvering around the likelihood of jury nullification of the prosecution. For hundreds of years under the English criminal law, there is a practice by juries of finding the fact in larceny prosecutions that the goods taken are less than the statutory limitation. That is, jurors return in the 18th century with respect to the theft of private property, pickpockets in the street, the verdict that the handkerchief or other personal property stolen is worth 9 shillings 9 pence, in order to avoid the possibility that at the level of a theft of 10 shillings, a human being might be hanged. The use of the jury's power to find the facts as a method of subverting the cruelty of a criminal law which makes capital punishment the only penalty for felony is what it is that the lawyers at the first level have to work around in order to get their leading case. They have to convict Dudley and Stevens of murder. In order to do that, they have to overcome the possibility that the jury will acquit or find facts amounting to the justification for a lesser verdict, or, for that matter, even simply refuse to act without a clear signal from the trial judge that there isn't going to be an execution. But that's not what Huddleston is forging. Huddleston is forging that portion of the special verdict of which the jury is completely unaware, that is, the jurisdictional question whether the dinghy was a British vessel. For after all, there is the unwanted, but in the cases of the law of the sea, inevitable question of jurisdiction on the high seas. This is, after all, a moment of what it would be wrong not to call imperial justice. The British Empire, on which the sun never sets, exists in the South Atlantic, not by virtue of having made Victoria the Empress of the South Atlantic, as they have made her the Empress of India, but because of some invisible, notional, non-existent, but nonetheless hypothesizable English-British flag, a Union Jack flying somewhere in the neighborhood around the dinghy as it would have flown from the mast of the Mignonette. Except it didn't, of course. The Mignonette did have a flag, as Simpson is sharp-sighted enough to point out, but it wasn't a Union Jack, and it didn't reflect the fact, though it was a fact, that the Mignonette was a British registered boat. So after all, the ability of the court to say, yes, the boat is there, the law is here, but the law over here applies to the boat over there, depends upon the facts of registration and the fact that the dinghy involved was the boat of the Mignonette. And neither one of these two facts was correctly reflected in the special verdict as Huddleston drafted it, as counsel approved it, as the jury gave their assent to it, or as the jury ultimately signed off on it and returned it, or would have returned it, had it been returned at all, as the verdict of the jury, which it never was. And in the welter of all of this, what Huddleston actually does is simply to modify the document. As gross an interference with, as strong an example of obstruction and lying as you could want. No different than if the jury had returned a verdict of not guilty and Huddleston had taken his pen and crossed out the not. And yet there it is. This is what was done, because the flattening of all these minor technicalities is what is necessary in order to achieve the symbolic goal of the entire activity, which is the writing of an opinion that calls Tom Dudley a murderer. So this both trivial and atrocious modification of the verdict, this utter contempt for the integrity of the system of justice, is a necessary part of the cost of doing business, for the business of the transmutative magic of the law. And again, I say, we ought not for an instant to think of this as some story about 1884 that has no other meaning in the world. Exactly 100 years after these events, in the United States Supreme Court, at the end of 1986, a case involving the pretrial detention for dangerousness provisions of the 1984 Omnibus Crime Bill came before the justices. The 1984 Act provided, for the first time in the criminal justice history of the federal government in the United States, and almost for the first time anywhere in the United States, that it should be legally possible to allow the pretrial detention of a party on the grounds of dangerousness. In other words, a party indicted for a federal crime. An indictment is a finding of probable cause, but is not, as we have told juries for 200 years, evidence of guilt. An indictment returned against the defendant in the federal courts. The 1984 Act made it for the first time possible for the prosecution to ask the district court for a pretrial indefinite, or at least lengthy pretrial detention, on the grounds that the defendants are, by clear and convincing evidence, dangerous. No guilt having been proved, nothing but probable cause having been established, nonetheless, pretrial confinement on grounds of dangerousness. The 1984 Act was swiftly held unconstitutional twice by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In one case involving Puerto Rican separatists, political activists who had engaged in bank robbery in Connecticut in order to fund their violent activities against the imperial control of Puerto Rico by the United States government. Judge John Newman found that the 1984 Act was a violation of due process for the jailing of those before trial who had not been proven anywhere to have committed any offense. And Judge Newman's opinion was concurred in by the then Chief Judge of the Second Circuit, Wilford Feinberg, who felt that whatever the case might be with respect to pretrial detention, it could not be too long involved. In the Hartford bank robbery case, the United States government held the defendants for 2 years before trial on the grounds that translating their wiretap intercepts from Spanish was so burdensome and complicated that they could not be brought speedily to trial. And in Judge Feinberg's view, whatever else might be said, 2 years of pretrial detention without proof of crime was too long. The second of the two cases holding the Pretrial Detention Act unconstitutional was decided by Judge Amaga Kearse, who held simply and straight away that the act was unconstitutional as a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Because without proof of any risk of flight, pretrial detention for mere asserted dangerousness violated the constitutional right to bail. The United States government had a choice of which of the two cases to bring up. The Hartford terrorists were the more unattractive defendants in the government's view, but the 2 year pretrial detention and Judge Feinberg's concurrence obviously weighed a little bit on the mind of the Justice Department. The defendants in Judge Kearse's case were also unattractive from a social point of view. They were the head of the one of the five families in the world of the New York City Southern Italian Mafia, and one of his capos, one of his understrappers, who were being held in pretrial detention pending what was called the commission case. That was a prosecution brought by the then U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, one Rudolph W. Giuliani, against the heads of all five of the families for their role in the so-called commission of the families, which met to preserve the peace treaty among the criminal tribes, and which had, according to the indictment, ordered several murders of soldiers in the different families in order to maintain the peace. So Anthony Salerno, then said to be the head of the Genovese family in New York, and one of his soldiers, Vincent Cafaro, known according to the federal government as Fish, though I was, after some acquaintance with the case, unable to find anybody other than a federal prosecutor who had ever referred to Mr. Cafaro as Fish. Vincent Cafaro and Anthony Salerno were the subject to pretrial detention for dangerousness in the commission case, and it was upon their petition for a review of the constitutionality of their confinement that the United States government eventually went to the Supreme Court. That case, Salerno against United States, is the leading case on the constitutionality of pretrial confinement for dangerousness, and it was the United States government's intention, as it was 100 years before in the case of Dudley and Stevens, to get itself a leading opinion. When Salerno reached the United States Supreme Court, however, the matter was in a confusing procedural position. By the time the case reached the Supreme Court on cert from the Second Circuit holding, Mr. Salerno had been already sentenced in another one of Rudolph Giuliani's anti-mafia cases to 100 years in jail. The sentence had been passed, and the judgment sentencing him to 100 years in jail was on appeal. It therefore would have appeared to anybody that the ruling with respect to Mr. Salerno's pretrial detention in the commission case was moot, since he wasn't in for pretrial detention. He was in for 100 years in jail. While the petition was pending cert in the United States Supreme Court, the trial judge in the other prosecution of Mr. Salerno, one Richard Owens, previously a United States an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York before going on the bench. Mostly, I think, in his own mind, Judge Owens was an opera composer. He was a senior when the Salerno prosecution was assigned to him, not through random assignment, but through the mysteries of the back channels of the SDNY. And he spent most of his time not trying cases, but composing unperformed operas. But Judge Owens one morning woke up with a sudden brainwave all by himself, never having spoken to another human being about it, and he went to the office and stayed his own 100-year criminal judgment sentence against Anthony Salerno, apparently believing that by staying the sentence he could unmoot the case on appeal, on cert in the United States Supreme Court. It wasn't exactly clear why he suddenly took this brainwave to do it, but even more, it wasn't exactly clear why he thought that contributed anything. Because in the system of federal criminal justice, unlike that of the English royal courts in the era of Dudley and Stevens, we have mandatory appeal as of right from all criminal convictions in the federal courts. And therefore, the technical rule is that the moment that the district judge signs the judgment, that is, the sentence, as in the case of Dudley and Stevens, in criminal cases, the judgment is the sentence, not the verdict. From the moment that the judge signs the judgment after sentencing, the trial court loses jurisdiction immediately because there is an automatic appeal as of right. So the actual rule in the federal courts is once the judgment is signed, jurisdiction is vested in the Court of Appeals until the mandate of the Court of Appeals issues. And only if they vacate the judgment by ordering a retrial or other further proceedings below is jurisdiction returned to the district court. So Judge Owens' order with respect to the conviction of Salerno, his staying of the 100-year judgment of imprisonment, however it was that he had magically all by himself thought up the idea of doing it, was legally of no effect. It was a null order because he had no jurisdiction to issue it, but nonetheless he did. And so in the cert discussion at the Supreme Court, when cert was granted, which of course there were certainly four votes in the Supreme Court to do, a question arose at conference concerning the mootness of the case given Anthony Salerno's confinement. Now, Anthony Salerno was a distinguished enough New Yorker that, like one other up-and-coming distinguished New Yorker of the time, a fellow called Donald John Trump, he was well and truly represented by a lawyer named Roy Cohn. Mr. Cohn was not only a figure of extraordinary evil in the life of the 20th century in New York City, but he combined the representation of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and that of Donald John Trump, among other fine and upstanding New Yorkers, and Tony Salerno and other large pieces of the New York City Mafia. So for many years, Anthony Salerno had been represented in all his various toils with the law by Roy Cohn. But by 1986, Roy Cohn was fortunately dead of the disease AIDS caused by the human immunodeficiency virus, which was then at epidemic levels in New York. though a famous mafia lawyer and the lawyer for the New York City Catholic Church, Roy Cohn was also a famously only theoretically closeted gay man in a time of epidemic disease. At any rate, Mr. Cohn was unlamentably dead, but that meant that Mr. Salerno was lacking his longtime personal lawyer in the United States Supreme Court. And so he was being represented for the court's purposes instead by a fine up-and-coming organized crime lawyer in Boston named Joseph Cardinale. Mr. Cardinale had appeared in the United States Supreme Court on behalf of Mr. Salerno. Mr. Cafaro had not appeared on the cert petition at all. He was not knowingly, he was not known to be represented by counsel. No cert paper had been filed by him. The court wished to grant certiorari in the Salerno case because the Justice Department had made it the marquee leading criminal justice case concerning the 1984 Act. The Solicitor General of the United States, then serving, when Charles Freed, that before and after, still now a professor at Harvard Law School, personally signed the papers and was, in the end, the lawyer who gave the oral argument on behalf of the United States government. Everybody wanted it, but Mr. Salerno and his 100-year sentence. So when the conference decided to grant cert, they also decided that Fish Cafaro should appear in the Supreme Court just in case a mootness might break out with respect to Mr. Salerno. It thus became the job of the junior justice on behalf of the conference to do the administrative work. That is the job of the junior justice in the room, not only to open the door and get the coffee, but to perform the ministerial tasks required. And so the junior justice of the United States Supreme Court, one Nino Scalia, and the clerk of the United States Supreme Court, Joe Spaniel, that was actually his name, on behalf of the conference and the new Chief Justice of the United States, William Hubbard Rehnquist, phoned the last known telephone number of Vincent Fish Cafaro. You can imagine, if you like, the dialogue. They rang the number and someone picked up and said, "Yeah." And they said, "It's the United States Supreme Court calling." And the guy says, "Yeah, right," and hangs up. But after two or three more attempts, the unidentified voice at the other end agrees that this might indeed be the United States Supreme Court calling. And they ask if Mr. Cafaro is available, and he isn't. But could he please file papers and appear in the United States Supreme Court? "Okay, we'll get back to you." Click. And in due course, Joseph Cardinale filed a piece of paper that said that he represented not only Mr. Salerno, but also Vincent Cafaro, and therefore everybody felt happy and things could go ahead. I now have to say that in Justice Marshall's chambers, the papers are sitting on my desk. I am the clerk who has drawn this lucky matter. And a couple of days after cert was granted, I got a call from a party in New York City somewhere, a little bird. And the little bird says to me, "You need to read an opinion filed under seal by Mary Johnson Lowe, DJ, such a date, in the prosecution of Vincent Fish Cafaro." "Really," I say, "why must I do that?" "Oh," says the little bird, "you want to read this opinion because Vincent Fish Cafaro has been released on $2 million cash bail in this order under seal that Mary Johnson Lowe DJ has filed secretly." "Gosh," I said, "really, you mean he isn't in jail?" "Yes, that's right, he's not in jail." $2 million cash bail," I said. "Yes," says the little bird. "Gosh," I say, "the Nebbia hearing must have been quite something." A Nebbia hearing is the hearing in the federal courts that occurs when you walk in with a suitcase with $2 million in it to make cash bail, and the court not unsurprisingly wishes to ask the question, and where, sir, did you get those $2 million, right? So when you put up large cash bail under suspicious circumstances, a Nebbia hearing is the inquiry into whether these funds are the proceeds of crime. And so I said, so the Nebbia hearing must have been quite something. And the little bird says to me, but there was no Nebbia here. I said, I see. So you wish to tell me that I should read an opinion under seal by Mary Johnson Lowe, D.J., releasing Vincent Fish Cafaro from the jail under the conditions of the putting up of $2 million cash bail without an Nebbia hearing. Yes, the little bird says. I see, I say. This is indeed a very interesting story. Why would that happen? And the little bird says to me, because Vincent Fish Cafaro is a government informant and he is wearing a wire to the meetings of the defense team in the commission case. Ah. So I go to the clerk's office downstairs and I say, we need to get this order by Mary Johnson Lowe, DJ, such a day, such a case, such a docket number, please. And the clerk calls up the SDNY clerk's office and they say, we can't give you that order, it's under seal. And the clerk of the United States Supreme Court, actually his deputy, Chris Vassil, says, now you did hear me say that this is the United States Supreme Court calling, correct? And so after a little back and forth, the SDNY clerk's office agrees that indeed, actually, the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court, and they send up the order, and it turns out to be as described. This is the moment at which it appears that I'm going to get up the Chief Justice's nose a little bit. Because my boss and I agree, and we send a memo around to the conference with the order attached. And we say, so there's a clear mootness of this case with respect to Anthony Salerno, and here is this order attached that demonstrates that there is no custodial incarceration of Mr. Cafaro either. He's out on secret bail, and therefore we believe that there is no case here at all because there's nobody in confinement under the pretrial detention order to challenge the order. One other member of the conference, Justice John Paul Stevens, thought that this was a serious point and suggested that the views of the SG should be called for on this particular question. The new Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, like Baron Huddleston and William Dankwartz and the Minister Harcourt, was grieved at the idea that this leading case for which he had intended such great things might evaporate on a mere technical issue. And thus, on the Friday, when Justice Stevens suggested in the conference room that there should be an order of calling for the views of the SG, the new Chief Justice, sitting for what I guess the third or fourth time in conference, told the other justices that he would not discuss it because it was not on the agenda, which, having served on the United States Supreme Court as an associate justice for 16 years already, he knew was not the local tendency of the Supreme Court. And there was some silence around the conference table. And on Monday morning, the Chief Justice sent around a memo headed by the sentence, we are an appellate court, not an investigative bureau, which was designed to say that the fact that the Marshall Chambers had unearthed these facts suggesting mootness didn't really matter because we're an appellate court, not an investigative bureau, and he was going ahead full steam. Magically, when the United States government filed its reply brief on the merits, under the signature of Charles Fried, Charles, the reply brief had a footnote in it which said, Fish Cafaro had been released for emergency medical treatment and was therefore still subject to the pretrial detention order. This was an odd thing for the Solicitor General's office to do because it was evidently not true. At oral argument, Justice Marshall happened to ask Charles Freed, who the Solicitor General, who was arguing personally, Justice Marshall happened to ask in a casual sort of way what the status was of Vincent Fish Cafaro. And my boss loved trapping questions. In his long career on the bench, he asked way more subversive questions, I think, than all the questions Clarence Thomas will ever ask. By two orders of, by an infinite amount of Clarence Thomas never asks any questions. At any rate, the Solicitor General stood in the United States Supreme Court and told an untruth to the court. Mr. Freed repeated the statement from the reply brief to the effect that Cafaro was subject to medical treatment, which we all knew wasn't true. It just wasn't clear whether the Solicitor General was lying to the United States Supreme Court or whether Rudy Giuliani had lied to him. At the time, of course, Rudy Giuliani was thought to be a sort of person who wouldn't do a thing like that. Now, all these decades later, we might come to different conclusions. At any rate, the Chief Justice of the United States didn't want to pursue the question. This is this was, from his point of view, as inconvenient as the special verdict was to Baron Huddleston. And therefore, he told the court that we were an appellate court, not an investigative bureau. For the 2 weeks following his circulation of that memorandum, I began to answer my telephone in the United States Supreme Court, "Good morning, Supreme Court Investigative Bureau." Needless to say, this was told to the Chief Justice, and he was pissed. That's how we came to have the little conversation that I have mentioned to you once before, me with my armload of flowers, him with his back pain. "Eben, you have friends in this building?" "Yes, Chief, almost everywhere." But as I say, neither this story from 1986 nor that story from 1884 are any really different from what we will perceive in our practices again and again all the time. The law's need to bend the facts is evident every time an appellate court restates them creatively in its opinion, and you haven't read the record below, and you don't know whether what the court is telling you the facts are or what the facts are, because there's no penalty for appellate court misrepresentation of fact. As there is no penalty for Baron Huddleston for forging the special verdict, the law's necessities are not for justice, but for the opinion, for the statement of justice, for the language of justice, for the symbols of justice, for the rituals of justice. And whether we confront this as Arthur Collins does, or we confront it as a law clerk does in the court when something smelly is going on, or whether we are ready to stand, well, you see, of course, what it is that Robinson was shooting Major Mouth about, or threatening to shoot Major Mouth about, in the case of the Serbian Fujinese kid. The question is always, who is willing to break the fourth wall on the drama of justice doing? Who is prepared to say, one way or another, that, well, you may really be thinking here about your opinion or the swiftness of your case or the smoothness of your precedent or the importance of upholding the law, but... And this is why, for me, the greatest of all the moments for us to learn from, the one that matters most in trying to understand the nature of the lawyer's work in the world, is the moment at which Arthur Collins has to decide what to do about Huddleston's fraudulence. Everybody here is intending to play the game. Mr. Collins is carefully trying to decide, in the interest of his client, how much trouble to make, because he knows that what the oracles of the law want is to write an opinion about Dudley, not to execute him. And he wants Dudley out and home and safe, and that's what it is his job to achieve. And there's a limit to how much troublemaking will achieve that. He needs to find some way to get the legal question of the defense of necessity before some court. Huddleston can clearly outmaneuver him at assizes, maybe also in the Court of Crown cases reserved, because all of the patchwork procedure they are making up in order to get the thing before some judges and get an authoritative opinion is causing enough bolts to fall out the bottom and enough smoke to emerge from the tailpipe that they're not absolutely sure they can manage it. But Collins is not absolutely sure that forcing every point is going to preserve his client's safety best. But he must do something about this raucous illegality on Huddleston's part, and watching him solve that problem is the best education we can have. And you see that moment in the first hearing in London, when the procedural structure supposedly is that the Cornwall Assizes have been adjourned to Huddleston's courtroom in London, and Collins says, "May I have the shorthand notes of the trial, Your Honor?" And Huddleston knows that the shorthand notes of the trial, in which he reads over the special verdict form and it's taken down as it was read to the jury, is going to cause him a little bit of trouble, because that's not what the parchment reveals anymore. And so he tries to bully Collins out of asking, "What would you want the shorthand notes of the trial for?" And Collins says, "I wish to read them, my lord." That is the moment at which he delivers the same message that we hear Robinson delivering in indirect quotation about shooting Major Mouth. Of course, Arthur Collins, too, is a figure in the empire. He's about to go and be knighted and appointed to the justiceship in Madras. He's going to be the British Empire in Tamil Nadu. He's going to be the man who represents the majesty of the English law to tens of millions of people who live under the beneficent sway of the Empress of India, Queen Victoria. He's not threatening outright revolution. He's certainly not proposing to fling a brickbat at the judge. But on the other hand, with beautiful simplicity and elegant, aggressive clarity, "Why would you want the shorthand notes of the trial?" "I wish to read them, my lord." So here is the moment at which an extra insurance policy on his clients' lives being taken out by Arthur J.H. Collins, QC. An example of how, well, to coin a phrase, we're lawyers, we are never far from evil, from fraudulence, from forgery, from what would, under less white glove circumstances, be seen as an attempt to railroad two men to the scaffold. But of course, it's a very sophisticated, very complicated, very symbolic game. And it is the game which is being played on all sides, except the side of Tom Dudley and Edwin Stevens, who are men of the sea who decided who should be sacrificed. Writing as an embedded correspondent for The New Yorker in Normandy in 1944, A.J. Liebling recounts his morning conversation with one of the cigar chompers of the United States Army, Brigadier General Terry Long. They're eating breakfast in the general's tent in the last week of June of 44 after D-Day. And Liebling is asking the usual reporter's naive questions about how the general sees what's going to happen next. And the general breaks him off with great vigor, let us say, and points to the map on the wall behind his desk and the flags on it. And he says, you know what these mean? He says, this flag here means that at 10 o'clock this morning, 50 of my men are going to be dead. And this flag means that at 2 o'clock this afternoon, 150 of my men are going to be dead. And this flag here means that at 5 o'clock this afternoon, 500 of my men are going to have died. The form of imperial stiff upper lip, quasi-military candor and savagery that is good leadership is crying out against the idea that war is merely something that happens, and pointing out that it is massive industrialized human sacrifice. Sacrifice in theory to a cause rather than to a deity, but to the ineluctable element of fate, to the fact that sometimes in war, in pestilence, against the absolute and unfeeling remorselessness of nature, sacrifice occurs. Maybe here too you have still the priceless gift of the young. Maybe you have never had to kill. Maybe you have never had to consider killing. Maybe you have never sacrificed anyone. Maybe you have not even, through a moment of inattention, stupidity, naivete, or just plain bad luck, come close to sacrificing yourself. But that, the reality of sacrifice, is what the case ultimately is about denying. Coleridge, in rendering the opinion for which all has been done, for which all the fraud and the forgery and the procedural chicanery was undertaken, Coleridge, after all, is about writing an opinion which demands what it sees as higher sacrifice. That all men in future placed where Tom Dudley is placed should be willing to do away with themselves, to sacrifice their lives rather than to take the life of the boy. Because, of course, there isn't a leader worth her salt who wouldn't consider self-sacrifice before murder, right? Or at any rate, most of us who think of ourselves as leaders think we wouldn't. What is it like to know that it's just the kid's bad luck, his inexperience, his love of the world, and his desire to grow that has gotten him into mortal danger, And who, in the role of parent or mentor or leader or guide or captain, wouldn't consider, and yet. And this is why, of course, to be a general and to be engaged in the wholesale sacrifice of human beings to the gods of war is such a hard role to understand. Where such an idea, such a form of empathy, such a desire for the substitution of one victim of sacrifice for another is not only impossible, it's completely antithetical and forbidden. And Dudley may very well think of himself that way. Not just as the father of his daughters and the husband of his wife, who has a life before him and they before them in Australia after emigration, but who thinks, as he thought in those crucial moments when the Mignonette was sinking and he was below deck with the water at his neck to find his instruments, that it's his job both to endanger himself and to determine who is sacrificed. And who has, by his own force of personality, maintained sufficient authority in the boat for 20 days that he can still both believe in himself and exercise his right to control how sacrifice is made. But the law's effort is to make sacrifice more general, less distinct, to give a miasma of moral judgment to what is actually underneath some more fundamental occasion. And here we begin to meet the greatest of all the mysteries below the surface of this case. The mystery about the lots. The mystery about the lots is not merely the inconsistent treatment of this question of an equal chance to die that comes up in the vernacular culture of the custom of the sea, that is expressed in the shanties, that is part of the expectation of the community, and that is the one weapon of public relations open to the system of the law as it attempts to convince the culture of the sea, of the sea peoples, of the maritime England, to go along with them in the condemnation of Tom Dudley. He did not draw lots. But what is the meaning of this drawing of the lots? In the late 1970s, in southern England, a work crew digging up a peat bog for real estate development, a backhoe slicing up, you know, long vertical segments of peat from the bog and lifting them into the dump trucks to carry away, the operator noticed as he lifted one stack of peat into the truck that sticking out from the peat was a piece of a human arm. And so work stopped and the usual forms of archaeological stay were put on in place, and the effort to recover what was there began. And what came out of the bog was a man. In extraordinary state of preservation, not a skeleton, but skin and flesh and bone. Because peat bogs are enormously oxygen-deprived environments with a mixture of acidic water and vegetation, but no oxygen, in which organic remains can last long without decomposition. The bogman, so-called, was an unusually well-preserved form of the soft tissue fossilization of a human being. He was an Iron Age human being, from, let us say, you know, 700 years or so before the Common Era. And he was so well preserved that both the manner of his death and the nature of his last meal were still organically recoverable. He had a not quite decomposed cord wrapped tightly around his neck. He'd been hit in the back of the head by a heavy, blunt object, and he had been stabbed. So, what was the occasion of this violent overdeath, this strangulation, blunt force trauma, stabbing end? As I say, even his last meal was accessible in his stomach. There was there a piece of bread, like a hoe cake or a cornbread cooked on a griddle as a lump of dough, and then sectioned into pie-shaped triangles. And this last meal was immediately before his death. The bread was not digested in his stomach in all those centuries. It had rested there, as all of him had rested. And on the underside of the bread, there was a little burnt symbol based upon the impression of a red-hot signet into the dough before it was baked. He was a human sacrifice. They made the dough, they burned the symbol into one fragment of it, they baked the bread, they cut the slices, and the one who got the branded one, the one who ate the branded slice, he was immediately sacrificed, and his body was thrown into the bog. The drawing of lots isn't a judicial activity. It's not a maritime activity. It's a message to us from ourselves about the meaning of sacrifice, about the way we let the gods choose whom they take. And all the long history of the human race rolls it along with us. But Tom Dudley is a modern man. What? Me, sir? That's what the law always means. In its choices, in its supposed rationality, in the strength of its ability to turn its magic into science, it is still a system of evolving symbols round the realities of our sacrifices. Shall we reopen the economy for Easter? Pack the churches? Ours was not a society made to be shut down. But we do not draw lots for those we sacrifice. The plague does that. Talk to you soon.